This is the State of Things, broadcasting from Upstage Cabaret at Triad Stage in downtown Greensboro. I'm Frank Stachow. Thank you. Deanna Kelly Saeed has found herself at the intersection of religion and romance on many occasions. After converting to Islam, she fell in love with and married a Muslim man from Afghanistan. Their union allowed her to go places where Muslims were not a minority. She relied on her faith for strength to end that marriage after 11 years. Deanna's story is featured in a new anthology called Love Inshallah, The Secret Love Lives of American Muslim Women. The essays show a diverse range of female Muslim voices on love, relationships, and sex. The book succeeds in challenging stereotypes about Muslim womanhood. For example, it was Deanna who proposed to her husband. Deanna Kelly Saeed is a writer based here in Greensboro, and I want to welcome her to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So you converted to Islam at the age of 21, grew up in a Baptist household in the rural South. What made you decide to convert?
Well, that's a very long story, but after being exposed to Islam, particularly through Islamic intellectuals, I realized that when you strip away the cultural assumptions of Islam and look at it from a theological perspective, it's a religion that really requires the heart bone and the mind bone to be connected. It requires thought and thinking ability, and compassion. And that is something that really drew me to the religion.
What was your earliest memory of religion? Were you raised in a religious Baptist household?
I was raised in a casually observant Southern Baptist household. My earliest memory of religion, believe it or not, when I was 3 years old, I had a dream of Jesus. And I was in this big stadium, and Jesus was presenting me a gift. And that's a very heavy burden for a three-year-old to carry, believe me. But from that moment, I was interested in spirituality.
So you're interested in spirituality. You confront this idea that the mind and the heart need to be one in any kind of religious experience, and you find that in Islam. Did you find that first, or was it the man who would become your husband who got you interested?
Well, interestingly, that idea of the intellect being part of worship is what brought me into Islam. And it's also what led me to leave my marriage, because I felt the marriage, which, and my husband was very kind to me, by the way. He never mistreated me. But I felt his concept or his approach to Islam was not, in a way, spiritually beneficial to me. It just intuitively wasn't who I wanted to be as a Muslim.
The idea that there's a strong intellectual component to Islam is something that seems to be lost in much of the discourse in this country about Islam, which is routinely presented as a kind of backward, regressive religion.
Exactly. And unfortunately, that's how the mainstream media presents everything. But even if you go to the Muslim world, and I've lived and traveled extensively throughout the Muslim world, through Central Asia and the Arab world, sometimes you will find illiterate Muslims who look just like what you would think a terrorist may look like, but they are the softest, most compassionate people you will ever meet. And there's something so profound. You know, all of this, the discourse that we see of Islam and these stereotypes, they're things that are projected upon Muslims, and only less than 1% of Muslims actually fulfill those requirements. The rest of us, regardless of how we look, whether we wear the veil or not, we're frustrated because we want to speak our truths, and sometimes that's very hard. And Love Inshallah, The Secret Love Lives of American Women, have allowed many Muslim women, at least 24 of them around the U.S., to speak their truths of being women who love and lust and feel hurt when relationships end, or, and who are complete women, just like anybody else.
Now, is this a book that's only possible in countries like the United States? There are parts of the Muslim world where you couldn't publish that book.
That's probably very true, but the discussions do happen in private in the Muslim world, for sure.
You talked about in your essay your own struggle with your physical appearance and that you had been dissatisfied with the way you mm-hmm. look. How much did that play a part in your first searching and seeking a religion and then finding Islam?
In a lot of ways, when I first became a Muslim, I didn't dress in the modest capacities that many people insist Muslim women should dress like. But when I did take the veil or the hijab, I did it for my husband. And I was okay doing that because it was a form of cultural performativity. But it was a way for me to hide because I felt so ashamed about my body and about my weight. And at one point I realized that by using it to hide who I am, That is not the appropriate use of the Islamic veil. That's not the appropriate use to allow it to wallow, to allow it to not deal with my insecurities. That's not honoring the veil, and that's one reason I decide to remove it.
Though there is some thought that there is a kind of shame about female sexuality, a kind of blame that goes along with that covering. It's your fault that I've been seduced and therefore cover up. Are we right about that? I mean, to what extent is that part of the veil?
From a cultural perspective, there is an assumption that women are responsible not only for their sexuality, but for controlling men's sexuality as well. And that's really, from a theological perspective, that has nothing to do with it. Men are completely responsible for their misbehaviors, and you can't blame a woman for, you know, turning you on. That's, you know, you have to manage that. But from, you know, the most beautiful announcement I've ever heard about the hijab is it creates a barrier that prevents negative energy from hitting you, negative energy from the world. It creates this barrier. And I love that because that removes all this subjectivity and sexualization from it. It's really a gift, and it's a gift for women to decide how they embody it, not for men.
But there are places, again, where they don't really have the right to make that decision.
Of course. Yes, definitely.
So let's get some more of the biography. How did you meet the man who would become your husband?
I was already Muslim, but I was working as a program assistant at the United Methodist Church headquarters in New York City. He was a landmine expert, and I like to say we met in a church and because of bombs. And Muslims don't joke about these things, okay? So it's an interesting story. He was at a meeting with the United Methodist on doing landmine removal projects in Africa.
And you met. What was your courtship like?
Oh, it was very, very innocent, I can assure you. I moved to Washington, D.C. A few months after meeting him where he was based. I moved for a job, not for him, but we kept in touch. And it was all, he was so gentlemanly, and at some point I'm like, you know, I really like you. And because he was a traditional Muslim, I knew he wouldn't have any ill intent in associating with me. And he said, well, I kind of like you too, and I'm sort of looking for a wife. He had 5 children from a previous marriage.
So, yeah, he's looking for a wife. But did he have custody of the children?
Oh, yes, he did, yeah. And I've raised them.
So that's the courtship, and you did eventually get married and then traveled quite a bit.
I did. He is a United Nations diplomat, so I've lived abroad, and there was a while I was living in the Persian Gulf as a diplomat's wife, basically as an ambassador's wife.
You proposed to him?
I did.
What made you do that?
Because I was lonely and I wanted a husband.
What, and was good enough reason, I guess. And was he shocked by that?
No, I don't think so. I think he said, well, I kind of like you too, and maybe we should talk about getting married.
Wow. So this isn't not done in Muslim cultures.
Well, no,
apparently,
it's not done.
It was okay with him. And then you traveled around. I'm curious to know what this did to your identity as you find yourself in predominantly Muslim countries. You're an American, raised casually Baptist, converted to Islam, and now you're in this other culture. Did you start to lose yourself?
I never lost myself, but I started to recalibrate my identity as more of a global American, which I feel is where we are going as a society. Our identities as Americans are becoming more globalized, and it allowed me to also see how the world works. We have this assumption that the world is completely dysfunctional once you leave American, you know, the boundaries of our country. It's not. There is dysfunction, of course, but it's not complete chaos. And it allowed me to expand my identity as an American, but at the same time, it wasn't completely rooted. And this was a source of crisis for me individually and intellectually.
How did that crisis play out?
I came back to America in 2008 with all 6 kids, and I became a ghost hunter.
We're going to get to that in a minute, because we're not going to leave that one on the table. But I do want to find out more about this question of identity and the crisis itself. So what does that mean in practical terms when you say you have a crisis in identity? And certainly we can see why with all these influences. So on a day-to-day basis, what does that mean?
There are real ethical struggles when you're living in the Muslim world, and the American military is fighting a war in the Muslim world, and you have relatives who may have American bombs dropped on them. this is a real reality. And on one hand, you understand maybe you don't like American foreign policy, maybe you don't like the Taliban, but where do you give your allegiances to? Who do you profess truth to? And this is something that I struggled with. You know, where do you pass judgment, and can you pass judgment?
And did you find yourself having to do that? People expecting to hear from you? Where do you stand on this?
In my personal life, yes. I mean, it was very black and white.
And so you had to say something. You couldn't just kind of hide out.
Yes, yes.
Did that lead to tension and struggle with family members, for instance?
Well, to some degree, you wanted to. What I've always wanted to say is these things are never black and white. They're in shades of gray, and it's very complex. But some people can't deal with the complexity, so they have to draw these lines where everything is good or evil. Well, it's not. No, regardless of what one of our presidents said, you're not either for us or against us. It's not that simple.
Talk to us some more about these conversations that go on about sensuality and sexuality among women. Women do feel comfortable talking among themselves about these things.
Yes, very much so. In the Muslim world, women do have the same types of conversations about personal intimacy that we have here.
Did you have any way of knowing if you were getting a sort of a different view of this because you were an American, because you were a convert?
I think because I was a Muslim and I covered, people felt very comfortable with me, and I actually had access to interior spaces that non-Muslim women would not have had access to.
And were there places that you didn't have access to because you were an American?
No. Actually, I think being a Muslim really scored me brownie points in the Muslim world. Wow. And being an American also gave me the best of both worlds, wow, actually.
So eventually you did move to Greensboro. Good for you.
What brought you here? My mother was here.
How did she feel about all this traveling, and what about the conversion itself? Did that create trouble at home?
Not necessarily. She certainly had some concerns about being a Muslim and being married to a Muslim man and having 5 children and 6 once I had my own to take care of. But she was very happy for us to be here, and she really cares about my stepchildren now.
And you found in Islamic law and theology the means to sue for divorce.
Well, that's a loaded question. That's a very loaded question. I discovered that my husband and we were not actually married. We had a Sharia marriage, which in the end turned out not to be legal in the state of North Carolina.
Oh, but you got the 6 kids, and here you are in the state of North Carolina.
For now, I'm taking care of the ones that are in my home. Yeah.
So then what did you do when you found that out?
Well, there really wasn't much to do. Is just start to prepare to build your life and to go forward. And it's very scary. Anyone who's ever had to go through divorce or in a relationship is scary, but it also in some ways is empowering because it forces you to find your strength.
I mean, clearly, if you wanted to stay married, you could have made it legal. So things
course,
were breaking up at the time. Do women have much leverage when it comes to asking for a divorce?
It really depends at the individual and with the family. In general, no. Now, there are some discussions about it. At the theological level, there were differences of opinion. Family law is very problematic in the Muslim world. It's not very well developed. So this is one area of emerging concern for people who are doing work organizational development work and legal work in the Muslim world in trying to make family law accessible for women.
So, ghost chasing.
Yes, ghost hunting.
Ghost hunting. You don't chase them. You hunt them. Tell us about that, how you got interested. First of all, what is it?
Ghost hunting. If any of you have seen sci-fi's Ghost Hunters, that is what I do. I go to places that are allegedly haunted or into homes where people are claiming to have weird things, and I try to find out what's going on. And many times you can find out a very normal explanation for it, but sometimes weird things happen.
Yeah. Believe it or not, there is a connection between your Muslim identity and your becoming a ghost chaser, ghost hunter.
Ghost hunter. Chasing ghosts are quite hard. Ghost hunting. Yes, when I came back and got involved with ghost hunting, it was the first time in over a decade where I was interacting with everyday Americans. I had been interacting with international staff or, over abroad and in their country. The first time I was engaging everyday normal Americans and engaging my local history. And that was the little switch that helped me rediscover my American identity and put down those roots about who I was. And, it's so odd that it took a couple of spirits, not the kind you drink, mm-hmm. but a couple of ghosts to help me do that. And a couple of reality TV stars, the guys on Ghost Hunters, are now friends of mine.
But it does sound like that spiritual connection right from the time you were three, this sense of the other world crashing in on you has always been an important, a kind of a leader for you. Somebody's calling you forward.
Very, very much so. If anything, what paranormal investigation has done is allowed me to appreciate how wonderfully complex and magical our world is. You know, we often deal with the mundane stuff every day, but when something truly phenomenal happens, it's something you can't explain, you're like, the universe really is, there's still mysteries out there. And that's reassuring to me. That leads me to believe there is something higher than us, still calibrating our world, still inserting magic into our lives.
Now, many of these hunts end with real sort of easy explanations that may not be phenomenal or paraphenomenal, right?
Yes, yeah, of course.
Give us an example. I know there's a couple of cases where, for instance, the mother of an autistic boy thought that he was demon-possessed.
Yes. She felt that this child was being possessed by demons. It was a 3-year-old autistic boy who was having fits, really severe fits, and she was convinced that he was possessed by demons. But when we went in and we sort of, I wasn't particularly involved with this case, but the team I investigate with was involved, and he said, you have a 3-year-old who's having the normal temper tantrums, but he's also autistic. You need to go to a doctor and check out for seizure disorders. Because, obviously, is it going to be seizures or a demon? Let's be realistic here.
No,
she just didn't have any other resources, and she was afraid.
And yet you have checked out some things that just defy explanation. Can you give us an example?
Right next in the county next door, Coroner's Folly. I was the first person to ever go in and do a paranormal investigation, and there are certainly some things occurring on a regular basis that we cannot explain. And it's all a very happy, comforting type of haunt.
What kind of things?
We have gone in and done an investigation where we have collected voices of children playing games in the middle of the night, 11:30 at night, when there were no children there. We've had things move in the home. Just really weird things that we can't explain. And the property itself is so unique and so fascinating that it lends itself to these type of things.
So have you, and I know you've written a book about this and the obsession that Americans have. We do want to know more about this, whether we suspend our disbelief. Do you have an explanation for things like that?
I really don't. It's still the mystery. It's part of the chase, as you put it.
See, I knew I was going to be right eventually, although it takes a long time. Yeah. Now you're working on another book on ghost hunting out in October.
I am.
Tell us about that.
It looks at the emerging ethical and philosophical issues about ghost hunting. As we mentioned, the autistic child, we have so many people, literally thousands of people around the country going into people's homes, into their most private spaces doing these ghost investigations. You have to consider the ethical implications of going in and telling someone you have a demon. Is that really ethical? And I look at those emerging issues and how to do research-based investigations.
Deanna, thank you so much. Fascinating.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Deanna Kelly Said, a writer based in Greensboro. She's the author of Paranormal Obsession, America's Fascination with Ghosts and Hauntings, Spooks and Spirits, and her essay, Muslim Girls Get the Blues, is featured in the anthology Love Inshallah, The Secret Love Lives of American Muslim Women. Coming up, we're going to chat with blues singer Logie Meacham. Here he is to play us out. Logie.
Live while you're living. Make some noise when you're dead. If you do, my baby's gonna tell you every word you've said. Make love while you're living. Live life before you're dead. And one day the whole world will know. They'll know everything you've said. We're gonna find you one of these. One of these bright mornings, you just might catch a breeze and come back our way. One of these old midnight stars, you might stop and tell us just what you've had to say. You might not say it while we're living. You might have to come back and tell us a word or two. But we'll have no fear of your life and love, and come on back and tell us just what to do. We just might need to hear from you. We might need to hear from you.
Come on back and see it.